Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
We're really excited today, aren't we, Mitch?
We are. We have Jared with us. Jared, I'll give you Jared's full name because I just want to be able to pronounce it. It's Jared Cooney Horvath. I feel great that I've nailed that one right now. Great to have you online with us, Jared. You're a neuroscientist.
Technically an educational neuroscientist.
Neuroscientist. Wow, that's fantastic. And you've also experienced the equilibration process with MJB seminars.
Well, you've done a lot of work with us.
You've done quite a bit of work with us.
We've gone straight through all three programs.
You have. And you did this how long ago? Like, is it 3 years ago?
It feels like – I think we wrapped up. So we would have started 3 years ago, finished about two. So, yeah, it's been a while.
And then it looks like life definitely took off from that point because, I mean, since then you've done a TED Talk, Your Brain, Your Life. You've also wrote a fantastic book, Stop Talking and Start
Influencing.
12 Insights from Brain Science to Make Your Message Stick. I feel very proud that you're on here with us, and it's great to be hanging out with you again because I always know that I think the listeners are going to love this because we always head down the rabbit hole and talk some really, really cool information to fucking demystify this whole brain thing, Jared, you know, and make it understandable for everyday people and lay people right through to high-end CEOs, to people who just want to be able to get ahead, to understand that, you know, the evolution in consciousness is a very real thing. Our understanding of the brain is at the forefront now of most major organizations and businesses. And people are, you know, through access to the internet, we're able to access information now. And we're starting to find ways to hack our consciousness and our ability and create the reality that we want.
And so, that's what I love. There's massive feedback too. Just listening to you say that from where we, so for the last 50 years, say, all the brain stuff's been coming out of the lab with a very clear story.
Yeah.
And only in the last like 5-10 years when the world has gotten a hold of that story and started to say, well, wait a second, how can we tweak it and push back? And now it's feeding back into our work and we're starting to say, oh, looks like y'all knew a little bit more than we did.
Yeah.
Teach us.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems that we have a savage appetite to understand things.
So before we get into this, right, I want to go back before we get deep in, because first up, it's, you know, Jared, because I'm sure you listen to Dorothy and the Dealer yourself, we like to start off our our podcast with a song.
Oh, yeah.
And so can you recommend a nice song or a song that you are listening to at the moment that we can off the cuff see if we can get Mitch to sing?
Or even if it's an oldie. Even if it's an oldie, you know?
Of course.
Even if it's an oldie.
I am Pearl Jam Alive seems to be my number one.
Do you know that one?
No, I don't.
Do you know that one? Can you sing it?
Just give me a line.
I would sing it, but my throat recently over a cold. So,
damn,
but I don't really play it.
Damn. So you like you're a bit of a rocker. You like a bit of Pearl Jam.
That's what, if it's got a heavy guitar, I'm happy. That's what, because you're a big U2 guy, yeah.
I'm an ex raver, buddy. So I'm a techno guy. You know, I'm a dance music, electronic EDM. Music. You know. But I don't mind a bit of Nine Inch Nails and I grew up with Slayer and Onslaught and Anthrax and, you know.
I can't deal with that. Definitely not.
You think you'd outgrow it. Most people did. For whatever reason, I just haven't. If there's someone screaming in my ear, it makes me feel comfortable. That's my best learning.
So what I think we might start with is let's just talk about how we met and a little bit about what brought you to us in the first place, Jared, because I think that will just help set the scene for us, like, connecting and what, you know, and where we took it to from there. So just can you talk a little bit to that?
So 4 years ago now, before we started, my wife and I, I'm from the US originally, but my wife is Melbourne born and bred. And so we had done the long distance thing for 3 years. I moved out here. We were together for another 6 years here. And we weren't sure where the heck it was going to go. And by the time we'd actually split at that point, moved into two different houses, and she came and saw one of your guys' seminars and we hadn't even spoken in about a month, but she called me and said, you have to go see these guys. She was talking about you specifically, Mitch. She's like, this guy is your guy.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, whatever. Good to hear from you. Love you. Bye. And went out the next night. You had another one in Melbourne, came out and saw you, and that was it. And I don't think she intended for it to get us together. I don't think in any way she was saying this can save our relationship. She was simply saying, hey, for you as a human being, here's something you need. And she was spot on. And it ended up I think I started the first course after that. About 6 months after that, jumped right in, and we went straight through.
Yeah, I remember the information that you were there, and I remember when we did relationships in you, and you were going through the equilibration process, and just so people
we'll talk
understand
about the equilibration process as we go through.
Just as we go through, we'll discuss what that actually is. But it's for us, it's a moment of shifting a person's innermost dominating thought, and which is generally the foundation of their reality. You want a new reality, you have to shift the innermost dominating thought that's creating the reality you're in. But it was magical to sit with you and you know, as I was talking you through and watch what was going on for you, and it was like, oh, you know, we're now literally rewiring the brain to see it in a completely different light. How was that for you? I mean, as a neuroscientist, I'm pretty sure that you would have been spending a lot of your time, you know, talking about the fact that this can happen, but to actually have it happen must have been.
It's hilarious I think the vast majority of what we do on our side, on the research side, is exactly, we talk about things.
Yeah.
And then we teach about things, but we don't know what the heck is actually going on. And this was one of the first times. So without getting too deep into the mechanism, you can assume, like you're talking,
innermost dominating thought.
Innermost dominating thought. So that is essentially the lens through which you see everything.
Yeah.
And I talk about it all the time about how that will literally dictate what you see, what you smell, what you taste, what you touch. It's not a perception thing, a down the track like interpretation thing. That literally dictates what comes into your body. And to feel it, almost like the only way I could describe it is you take out a filter, the old one, and put in a new broader filter. It was not, I don't know what I was expecting. It wasn't scary. It wasn't intimidating. It was like the most true moment ever. It was in that moment, you just kind of go, this is what it's all about.
Right.
The penny drops and it's not shaking. It doesn't, nothing about my well-being just totally exploded. It was pure peace and almost calm in that moment where it's like, I get it. I got a glimpse of what all of this means and how this actually works.
Yep.
And then to actually go through that, now when you go back and teach that stuff to your students, here's how the brain's working, here's how it's working.
Yep.
It's so much more honest and true. And when people say, is that really how it works? Yes, we're not just blowing smoke. This is really what's going on out there. And students have to listen harder because they feel it from you when you're like, this is it. This is the game we're playing.
Yeah, because you're going from talking to theory to saying, no, I've actually had a practical experience of this. This is a very real thing, you know. And it's like, I think, you know, it's like the first, I suppose for me, it was like the first time I ever took a hallucinogenic and I had a completely different mind-altering experience, you know. But when I did this consciously without any use of any hallucinogenic, it was like, whoa, my whole reality and how I see my whole reality at a very conscious level just changed. And it changed to elevate me more, to make more sense, to clear out some cobwebs, to allow some light in so I can actually move forward with more certainty, where beforehand I was operating in the world with doubt, which is when we're teaching stuff but we haven't had the practical experience of it. It's like saying, you know, theoretically I know what it is to be loved, but until you physically are loved, you don't know what you're talking about.
And how many people do that? I mean, even love is – how many people in the field of love and relationship counseling aren't married, don't have love, are divorced, don't even – but yet we still listen to them because the theory is good. But once you can combine that theory with the truth, with the understanding, it's just – it becomes so much deeper.
So, Jared, can you talk to us a little bit about your expertise and what you do and what it is you actually teach?
Yeah, so I neuroscience, educational neuroscience is the official title. So I was a teacher originally and then started studying the brain from a research standpoint and a medical standpoint. And so the only reason I've been doing all that research is so I can go back to teachers and students and say, hey, here's how we think and learn. So let's improve our ability in schools. So largely what I teach now is when I'm at university, I'll teach all the medical side of brain stimulation, of how the brain works, how it develops, neurogenesis, all that stuff. But on the practical side, when I actually get to go to schools, that's when I get to work with kids and say, hey, here's how you can take control of your own learning. And it's a very simplified form of getting them to recognize that, kind of like what you were saying, how you don't need a drug to get to a state, is that once you know the rules of this system, you run that system. So if I can teach them how they can run their own learning, ideally that gives them agency to start asking the bigger questions and say, well, shoot, if I can guide my own learning, can I guide my own thinking? Yep. Can I guide my own feeling and growth? Yep. Can I guide my evolution? You sure can. Once you get a little bit of power, let it go and watch what happens.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, because I like I've read your book. I love your book because I'm a teacher as well. So, you know, the whole concept of how do you make what you teach stick, you know? And I love how it's practical and experiential and all that stuff. So I think you did an amazing job with that. But in terms of, I suppose, your understanding of the brain, like I remember we sat down with you one time and you said, you know, you were talking about the brain and how the brain works, and you said that, you know, scientists have to laugh, you know, because in a few years' time you're going to look back and think about all the things you've just learnt and realise that it's all nothing, you know, like everything that you're learning about the brain changes every single day, right?
It just keeps moving fast.
And I mean, we could sit here for hours talking about some of the conversations we've had over coffees and stuff like that when we've caught up about how the brain's working and stuff. But you know, we speak about the innermost dominant thought and how it affects us so much. Can you talk to a little bit about how what's going on in the brain that actually creates that to occur?
So most people consider the brain what we'll call an active driver. It's kind of generating thought. And so what happens is the world comes in through your senses. You get all these signals rushing in, taste, touch, smell, sight, all these come in. They rush into the brain, they trigger off the brain, and the brain just then processes that. And the best we can do with that traditional theory is you do have the power to shut some things down in your brain. So for instance, if you don't want to do an action, like I can kick this ball, you can stop yourself from kicking a ball, but you're not really generating anything. The world triggers the brain chugs away, and the best you can do is kind of just shut it down when you don't want it to do its thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the traditional purpose. So essentially the world drives us, the brain chugs away, and we are nothing more than the end result of that process. Yeah. We now know that that's just not even close to being true. So in the front of your brain, in that prefrontal cortex, that thing that makes us human, that separates us from the animals, there's a little module, and just to be simple, we'll call it the coder. And it turns out this coder can send signals back to every other cell within your brain, and we're now learning outside of your brain. Tweak how each of those individual cells function. And I don't mean like kind of cutely. At the molecular level, shift those cells so that the incoming signals reflect what you want them to reflect. Mm. So whereas before we used to say the world comes in and activates the brain, we now say, no, 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 no. We have a part of our brain that pushes back and changes what those signals register.
It's
not being metaphorical. Literally what you see, smell, hear, taste, feel, the actual incoming sensations are changed, are dictated by what this little coder thinks they should be. Mm. So it's not a passive, let's just take the world in and let the brain chug away. It's a very active, let me push back and dictate how my body's going to respond to things. Mm. So go back to, and your listeners can look this up. There's a thing called the McGurk effect, which is, it's really, if you just type in McGurk on Google, you'll see a million videos of it. And that's when what you hear and what you see are very different in the McGurk effect. So in its simplest format, you listen to somebody say the word ba-ba, but you watch their face and their face is saying the word gaga. So the lips are saying gaga, but you're hearing ba-ba. And what happens is all of a sudden you hear tha-tha. It's like everything in your system shifts, and now you no longer hear Baba, you no longer see Gaga. Everything becomes this kind of middle ground, Dada. And for the longest time, we thought that was an interpretation thing. So Baba gets in your ears clean, Gaga gets in your eyes clean, and somewhere down the track, you just interpret it. Oh, it can't be that. It must be something else. We now know that's not true. When your eyes are closed and you hear Baba, the very first cells in your ear to start vibrating, you're not even in the brain yet, you're in the ear, just start vibrating, and they send Baba in from the very beginning. But as soon as you open your eyes, see the person's lips and go, oh, it can't be Baba, the coder sends signals back, and the very first cells in your ear, you're not even at the brain, shift their position, start vibrating, and it's Dada from the moment you hear anything. Wow. It's not a down-the-track interpretation. It's an in-the-moment perception thing based on what you think you should be seeing. Mm. So your coder – so this leads to that question. If I've got a coder changing all of this, what drives my coder?
Well, that's – I've written that down. Where something
That's where the innermost dominating thought comes in. Mm. That's where your stories, your understanding about the world, how it should be, drives that little sucker, and that little sucker then pushes back, and congratulations, that is literally all you get.
So then if you've had an experience in your childhood that makes you feel like I'm not good enough, or I'm not loved, or I was abandoned, you're saying that you will literally perceive the world in that way, and that's even before the information gets to your brain.
That is before you even start processing it. Right. Remember with young kids who've gone through trauma, especially in schools, there was always this finding that they would interpret smiles as grimaces. So if an adult smiled at a kid who had suffered a trauma, the kid would interpret that as a kind of like a growl, a snarl.
Yeah. Right.
And they'd see the teeth and they'd see it as fear. And we always just assumed that was an interpretation thing. We then started doing the imaging and we realized, no, it's an in-the-moment thing. When they say they see a smile as fear, they're not interpreting a smile as fear. They don't see a smile. There is no smile to later interpret as bad. Right. It is only bad from the first thing that starts processing that in the process. Brain.
Yeah. Wow.
And so when we say things like, just look at it differently, just see it differently, there's nothing for them to see differently at that point until you change that story.
Because I think that, you know, this gets down to, I mean – the first time I ever spoke about this concept, we got a lot of pushback. So people were saying, no, fuck you. What happened to me happened to me. How dare you say what happened to me didn't happen to me? And what I was saying was, no, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there's another way to see what happened to you. You're seeing it one way.
Well, you've perceived it.
You've perceived it one way. So the brain is perceiving, shaping your reality based on something that has occurred. But the question is, so people, it's like we see that people consciously want to change their lives. But it seems that the conscious processor is really fucking useless.
Until you can crack through it, it's running its own prediction. It's got your old story, and that's all it's ever going to want to do.
The question then is, the story is held seemingly in the more primitive centers of the brain, the more protective centers, mammalic centers of the brain, and it's just a series of loops. So it doesn't matter that people are saying to you, you can change your life. Or you're saying, I'm going to fucking change my life. I'm going to change my life. Well, then how come 6 months later you're still doing the same thing? Or to go, oh, my God, I realized that, you know, my fucking mum did this, or my dad did that, or the dirty old man down the street did this. It doesn't matter that you realize that stuff. That doesn't change anything. The question is, and how do we, you know, the process of what we've seen is, how do we get people to see that you have to change it at a subconscious level? Because if we change the loop, if we jam a screwdriver into that recording and into that loop, you know, and then we change the perception back there of what occurred and get the person to see it for how it actually was and how it enabled them and how it empowered them and what it taught them and gave them, well, then they will allow themselves, the subconscious mind allows itself to use that new data to be able to move forward in life. Because it seems that...
And I think you say it's subconscious, but what's weird is it's a subconscious shift, but it's also one of the most conscious things when it's happening.
Yeah.
you're almost hyper-conscious.
Yeah.
When it's occurring, you feel so much more above it all.
Yeah.
That you're like, this is what real consciousness, you're in, you're now driving this whole system.
Right.
So it's a subconscious shift, but occurring on a very conscious, not an effortful level where it's like, I'm just going to think my way through this. Yeah. But when it's happening, you're very much in that shift as it's occurring, and it's an incredible sensation, powerful as hell.
So we're talking about the shift now, though.
Yeah, we're talking about the shift.
Okay, but so I just want to get, before we get into, well, I'm okay that we get into that, but I just want to clarify a few things. So, you know, sometimes we say, Mitch, you know, somebody who's had an experience of abandonment, and we say they've perceived they've been abandoned.
Yep.
This is what we're talking about.
Yep.
We're not saying that somebody didn't leave you, but what we're saying is that in your perception, the way that you have taken in that information
at that time,
that this is what's happening. And I think that's a really Jared's helped us explain in a really scientific way exactly what's going on there. So what's coding the coder? Is the perception that we've had that we are not good enough or not smart enough or not intelligent enough or whatever. And so the information that we take in is we see that in the light that reflects that perception, right?
Yep.
What then, you know, when we're talking about that transformation moment or when we're talking about actually shifting that, like Mitch said, and let me, I think that this is, I'm hearing what you said, that you can't do that, you can't, when you said subconscious right now, you were talking about you can't just tell yourself that that person was smiling. You can't just tell yourself that everything was okay. What you're saying is at some other level, something has to change or something has to happen, which is obviously the process of equilibration that we use, but something has to happen at a different level in order to shift that.
Well, it's like, the way I see it is that if you record it as a moment and you just keep playing that moment over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, it's subconsciously. You're not consciously doing it. Nobody consciously wakes up tomorrow morning and says, hey, I'm going to play all these loops that are going to fuck my life up. You subconsciously are playing these loops. The problem is, so they're on play. You can shout at your phone for as much as you want that you're going to change your life.
Yeah.
But it doesn't fucking matter because you're pressing the wrong button.
Yeah.
You need to re-record, stop the play button.
And re-record. Very good. That's a good analogy.
By shifting the perception and looking at it now as an adult as to what actually happened.
So then scientifically, Jared, like in what's actually going on in the brain, can you speak to then what happens to actually do that, what Mitch has just described there?
So this is going to – I'm not going to get too deep into mechanisms because it gets weird fast. or at least too heavy fast. Most people will be like, chemicals click.
Oh, you know, so, can I say something though? As soon as this podcast is over, people are going to come back to us and say, you know what? We need Jared on again so he can go weird fast. That's the first thing people are going to say to us.
Give me those dopamine. Anyway. Give me the actual chemical name. So what happens when you, what we'll call is open the engram, when you flip into what you call your coder mode, where you actually access a story and put it on a pedestal where now you can tweak it, move it. So instead of just playing the video, you've now opened the video file in a video editing system.
Like an editing mode,
What happens is your brain flips into a mode called theta. So the way your brain works is ridiculously simple. It's constantly changing to adapt to what you require of it. So anyone who says the brain is somehow a driver or somehow a mover and a shaker, your brain doesn't do anything. It doesn't drive anything. It doesn't force anything. Your brain simply responds to what you ask of it. Run a loop again and again and again and again, and what happens is the brain gets really good at saying, sweet, autopilot. Whenever anything comes in, just run that story and make it as simple as possible. You'll see the brain actually will start to shrink around that story, essentially. It becomes highly efficient, becomes automatic.
That's similar to our bottom up that we talk about. Is that correct?
Bingo. Cool. Absolutely. Okay. So that's you're in your bottom up mode. Your story's run and everything's fine. When you open the engram, when you kick into coder, when you're now in editor mode, the system flips into a pattern which we call theta.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the big ways to change the actual patterning of your brain is a frequency pattern. So whenever you're forming a new memory, your brain goes into theta mode. Whenever you're learning a new skill, your brain goes into theta. Mm-hmm. Theta is the frequency by which things start to actually physically shift and say, uh-oh, Yeah. Let's change. When you go into, so during the equilibration, when you hit that coder mode and you enter the editing mode, the whole brain flips into theta. And at this point, whatever you think, whatever you do, how you choose to play with it will physically start to rewire that story so that your autopilot is different going into the future. Mm-hmm. So it opens the pattern by which the brain uses to change its own function. When you hit that equilibration point, that is that pattern. It's almost as if you hijacked a natural learning pattern in the brain. When it didn't want to get there, when it naturally wouldn't have gone there, you forced it to go there. And now it says, all right, what do you want? Let's update, update, update. And if you can change your thinking, go back to that moment, change your thinking about an event, a story, a thought, a concept in that moment, you come out of that with a bigger, deeper concept. Mm. And here's where I think it gets really quite cool is some people are always worried that they're going to lose their old story. Mm. And because their identity is very wrapped up in our story of who we are. I didn't make it 40 years of my life without having an effective story. So if I change that, who the hell am I going to be? Yeah. One of the big things to realize is when you change a story, you never lose the old one. You simply add a new, what we'll call broader perspective, a new layer to that story. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you maintain your old identity. It's just, you've got a wealth more identity now to draw on. Bloody. It's a simple example. It's going to sound stupid, but there was a day when you were a kid that you believed Santa Claus existed. And then there was a day when you found out he wasn't real. And in that moment, you didn't suddenly forget that you once believed in him. Now you had a broader story where you could both believe him and not believe him, mm-hmm. which is why when you see a kid who believes in him, you don't automatically go, nah, you're full of shit, kid. You've got enough of a wide story to recognize other people's stories, and you can sit broadly above it and go, I get all of this. Oh. That's the same thing with the equilibration. Yeah. You don't lose your story. You add perspective. You add around it until now you sit above it, and you can recognize, yeah, it's both sad and incredibly empowering at the same exact time. It's both scary and enlightening at the same moment. You don't lose yourself. You add to yourself.
Yeah, this is important because I think when people are listening to what we're saying about the alteration of your perception, sometimes people can think, well, then if I alter it, I'm going to turn it into a lie. No, in actual fact, what you're going to see is by shifting your perception, you will see the whole of the event and the wholesomeness that came out of the event. And how that wholesomeness now has been of service to you up until this point. And you will be very grateful for that event. But also now how this event has enabled you and empowered you to the point where if I say to you, would you undo it? No way. Would you gladly go through it again? 100%. Because you've seen the wholesomeness within the story. And so it seems then when people don't shift their perceptions, they're not driven by wholesomeness, but they're driven by a lie. And when they're driven by a lie around what happened to them back there, they don't get to use all of their power. You know, they don't get to use all of the blessings and the wisdom that it seems to sit dormant. And I think that I think that this is one of the reasons why we are so inquisitive, because there seems to be an innate knowing in every one of us. And this is why, I don't know why, maybe you're even a researcher and an educator in the area of the brain, because we know there's more than the fucking story. Like we know there's more than what went on, and we want to know more. But you're right. When you say to a person, you're not your story, they think, well, if I'm not that, who am I?
Who the hell am I? That's what the term equilibration then is so spot on with that. Mm. It's because you tend to think if we see things one-sided, it's either going to be the positive or the negative. It's going to be the heads of the coin or the freaking tails of the coin.
Yeah.
And to tweak a story isn't to just flip the coin over. Hey, congratulations, you now have a different side. It's to now see both sides. It's to sit above the coin and recognize, I can do anything I want with the coin. I can flip it up. I can tear it apart. Mm. I now get all facets of that coin. Yeah. So you don't lose it. You equilibrate it. It's good. Yeah. It's bad. It's up. It's down. It's right. It's left. It's all of the above.
Yeah.
And once you own all of it, now you're empowered over it. Now you do what you need to with it.
Yeah. Magic. Magic. Because I mean, people don't realize, but every time they tell a story, and you spoke about this really eloquently at one of our events, but every time you tell a story, you pull a file out, and depending on who you're telling the story to, you alter the story and you pop it back in, and then you're pulling it out and popping it in and pulling it out and popping it in. So you're just, you're embellishing the lie. And
eventually, every time you remember it. You remember it with the flavor. Yeah. So when you put it back in and you encode it, you remember it with the flavor of what it is where you were when you pulled it out.
Yeah.
And so every time you tell the story, it comes out different.
Yeah,
and it comes. So go back to you form your initial story, and we have this as you're building your first story. So it's your first time experiencing an event, whatever the major life event is going on. And let's just make it generically scary. It's 9/11 day. So here's a moment that no one's ever experienced. We're forming a new story in this moment for how we understand terrorism and the world and fear. Cool.
Right.
As it's happening, you're building your story. You're building your memories about it. Tomorrow you think about it, and what you're necessarily going to do every time you access a memory, it leaves wherever it was in your body, and it comes out onto what we call your working memory bench. And while you're thinking about it, you're necessarily going to start coloring it in the way you think you should have remembered it.
Right.
So I remember 9/11 should be bad. So when I think about my 9/11 story, I color it a little worse. I make it slightly worse. And the trippy thing with memory is every time you access a memory and tweak it, when you put it back, it goes back with that tweak. The old memory is dead, and all you have is the new one. And you'll fight to the death to prove that your new memory is accurate,
right,
even though it's demonstrably false. And so think about it. Over the course of 9/11 was what? Almost 20 years ago now. Yeah. If you can assume you've thought about it and watched documentaries about it and talked about it, God, 10,000 times between then and now, you've tweaked it every time you've accessed it to fit how you think it should have been. So now when I remember that 9/11 was a horrible day and a depressing day and there were tears and everyone was – you better believe my story has all of that in it. Yeah. I remember exactly where I was. I remember how depressed I was. I remember how my school essentially shut down. I remember how everyone came together and there were battles and there were arguments. And then you ask my roommate, who was in the same damn dorm with me at the same damn time, and he says every one of my memories is totally wrong. And he tells me a completely different story about how it happened. Mm. And we clash. And I hold my story. I'm like, no, 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 my memories are true. And he swears, no, 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 his memories are true. It's just that I used my prevailing story, my innermost dominating thought, to continue to tweak that memory to fit what I thought it should have been.
Right.
And now neither of us know who's right.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, neither of us are right at this point.
Correct.
We've just built our own stories.
And haven't there been studies done of people who've been interviewed interviewed just after 9/11 and then interviewed 10 years later and told same people totally different stories.
Yeah. Mm. And frighteningly how different the story was.
Yeah.
And when you ask them, hey, which of your stories was accurate, the one you told the day of or the one you told 10 years later, to a man, everyone will say the one I told 10 years later. Mm. I must have been out of my mind. I must have been in shock on the day of.
Yeah.
No, it's just when you change your memory, you'll fight to prove it.
But then when you think about it, right, then we're working with people and not just people, ourselves, obviously, but we're working with people who have had something happen to them perhaps in childhood. Yeah. And for 30 years then what we're saying is they've reenacted that, they've brought that up whenever necessary, and they have re-encoded into their memory a totally different version of events.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, their lives are based on this version of events. At the end of the day, the way that they're viewing their reality is based on this version of events. And we're not trying to diminish their experience of what happened, but at the end of the day, there was an experience that happened. And at the end of the day, do you want to live your life with reenacting the same experience over and over again and coloring it more and more and more every time, or would you like to see that there's another way that you can look at it? And I think that's what the equilibration process is.
And that's I think a good way to tap into it, or a way to ease people into that process, is to recognize the memory game, is to memorize the fact, is to recognize that we're changing our memories all the time. Yeah. Once I can accept that perhaps my understanding of the event isn't perfect, perhaps then I'll be more willing to take a look at that event.
Yeah, 100%.
And actually absolutely. Bring it online and say, okay, well, yeah. if I'm not totally true, what the hell really happened? Or yeah. The important thing to remember too is I think it's scary to talk about it in these terms because people are like, oh, I'm wrong. No, it's not that you're wrong. It's we just subtly shift everything to fit our story. So the easiest way to understand it is if imagine something bad happens today. I get in a car wreck, and it was a car wreck, and it was bad. But let's say it's like 50% bad. I'm not super injured. We all came out alive. I just totaled my car. Cool. What the coloring process does is every time I think about it, so tomorrow I think about it and I think, oh, that was a bad car wreck. Like I think it should be bad. Now I make it 51% bad.
Yeah.
Then I think about it the next day and now I'm like, it should be bad. So I just make it slightly worse to 53%. Now it's 54%. And over the course of years, I turn this car wreck into a 100% bad event. Mm. And I'm not saying it wasn't bad, but I'm saying if you could rewind that clock and go all the way back.
Yeah.
It's not as bad as you think it was, and there was an entire 50% over here that I haven't even chosen to look at, that I've just erased as I was changing this. So it's not that the memory's wrong. I mean, events do change, but it's our coloration of it and the weight we assign to it really starts to change as we just cycle this in our brain.
I mean, the other thing is that, you know, what's enticing about doing that? You know, why the frig would I want to go and do that? You know, and so what's enticing about doing that? And, you know, when I'm dealing with an entrepreneur, you know, who's reached a glass ceiling and they're not able to get past that glass ceiling and they're like, fuck, man, I've spent $250,000 in the past 12 months learning with all of these educators, how do I get past this glass? And I'm still in the same place. And you say to them, you know, it's all tied up in your self-worth, which is all tied up in some sort of story you're running in your head. Yeah. You know, you're able to get yourself to 5 mil, but you want to get to 10 mil. There's a different language at 10 mil than 5 mil. A person that operates at 5 mil doesn't speak the same way as a person that operates at 10 mil. But the common thread along the journey there is the language, and language is an expression, I believe, you know, it's one of the second ways in which we broadcast and create into our reality and tangle with our atmosphere, you know, and those particles to bring about the reality that we want. And I say to them, it's to do it what you're broadcasting, because life is listening and you're broadcasting from a loop. There's a loop in there that you're running that's affecting your self-worth. You don't innately believe you have the self-worth of a person that operates at $10 million. And so we have to look at what has gone on that you're doing that, so that we can build greater levels of consciousness, humility. We can build on your self-esteem, on your self-worth. We can see that wherever your caught back there, wherever this story is, wherever this perception occurred, it was actually designed to enable you to be able to handle this moment where we're questioning how to get you to where you want to get to.
So push to the next level.
Yeah, because your tools are there. You're just trying to do it in halves. You're trying to find a shortcut. There is no shortcut. You have to see. And so, we were talking a little bit earlier before we came live about hacking. You know, we're trying to hack consciousness. We're trying to get there at a quicker, more effective way. And I just think that what I've found is with working with people, including yourself, I remember speaking to you after STP and I was like, dude, you got to get on the road. You got information. You got to fucking do this. You got to just go. People will listen. People need to know. They need to know. And so that seems to naturally happen. That is why people, you know, when people are saying, well, why would I want to go back and look at the story? Well, because everything you need to be able to build your life happens through your history. Your history has left clues, but have you picked them up? You know, have you used what has gone on? Have you realized that when daddy left, this is who you became? But you're too busy being pissed off at Daddy leaving rather than going, fuck, okay, he'd never actually left. He just was replaced. And the father I got was amazing. And now I have all these tools and now I want to use these to be able to get ahead. So now you're no longer caught in the story.
And take your 5 million to 10 million story. That's interesting as hell. So at some point in my past, I've had enough events. I've built enough stories. I've created my dominating story. I drive that to 5 million and now I'm stuck. Joke is, I never would have gotten to 5 million had I not constructed those stories. So it served a wonderful purpose.
Yep.
Joke is, though, with that car that I built, that's as far as I'm going to go. Interestingly, in the time I built that car to getting to 5 million, I've generated enough new experiences and stories that if I stop at 5 million, get out of my car, take on my new experiences and change my car and say, okay, how do I use these to upgrade this?
Yeah.
Now I've got a broader, and now I can push to 10. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have gone from 0 to 10. In order to go to get to 10 million, I had to build my first car and get to 5 because that's what gave me the tools and the experiences to help me change my story and recognize it enough to now take the next journey. So I couldn't have skipped it, but how do I get, when I recognize I'm stuck, that's the point where I need to step out, get into my story and say, okay, what do I need? What's the next step? Thank God for everything that's come now. What have I missed? What do I need to throw back in? Yeah. How do I rebuild this car to keep pushing forward?
Yeah.
Well, I love it. That's a really cool, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
Well, I was just trying to get back with what you were saying about what actually makes us do that, because that's how you started your question.
Why do we do that?
Like, why do we not know that there's another car to get into, or that we, you know, that we can should get and that we can upgrade? Why do we keep re-accessing those things? Is it just because we don't know any better? Is it because is there a neurological thing going on that makes us do that?
Yeah, that's the biology problem. When you take consciousness, which let's assume is something but not necessarily biological, it's here, it's in everything, but it's not a cell. Now we have to clash consciousness with the constraints of biology, and one of the primary constraints of biology is just pure energy.
One of the
constraints of biology is just pure energy. So the good way to put it, so all the fuel you need to run your body, to keep your cells going, to keep your heart pumping, all of that fuel, 25%, when you're doing nothing, when you're just sitting there watching Netflix totally vegged out, 25% of all that energy is still going up into your brain. So the amount of energy this biology needs simply to stay alive is freaking incredible. In order to access and tweak your stories, that requires a ton more energy. So you can assume after an equilibration, you feel energized, but you sleep ridiculously well because you've just sapped everything that's in here. The brain needed that to rebuild its pathways. It's a physical system and it requires juice to move. So you can assume the biology problem says, the consciousness problem says, let's do everything. The biology problem says, yeah, but I got my limits. I can only do so much in a day. So the one way that the two kind of married each other was, consciousness said, cool, what I'll do is I'll build a story that's good enough, and then you can just run that on autopilot.
Whoa.
And so long as you can sit in that autopilot, then I've done enough of a job, you can keep chugging along, and we're not going to clash all that much.
And we're going to stay alive? I mean, you know, we're going to keep this system alive.
And taking the road of least resistance, which is actually just doing the easiest thing that's not going to take as much energy to, you know, expend.
And that makes perfect biological sense, is cool, so long as I can just keep chugging and you're making it through the day without getting killed, we seem to find a very nice marriage point. That's why we just cycle. So we call it the prediction mode. That's why you just cycle your stories. It's a perfect sweet spot between this and this working together. But that means, importantly, if you want to change a story, if you ever want to get in there, A, it's going to take some energy, and B, it's a visceral feeling. You know when it's happening, when you're in your conscious mode, when you're in your editor mode, because the biology has to shift for that to work. The biology, the way the energy is flowing through your body, and I don't mean energy in terms of way lines and fields. I mean literally chemicals of glucose that fuel your cells have to shift how they're functioning. All of that goes up largely into here. You can feel it happening. And some people hate that sensation. Mm. It's not always a very calm, comfortable feeling. Sometimes it's really tense. Sometimes it's tingly. I get a real big tension between my eyebrows. That's how I know it's starting to happen.
Right.
And once you get to that sweet spot where you recognize evolution doesn't always feel great, some people hate the feeling of it, then you recognize that when most people get there, a lot of people's their first reaction will be to say, shut it down. I just don't like the visceral sensation of it.
Oh.
Go back to me.
Right.
And if you get them to recognize, so take it on a much simpler level, let's just have kids making errors. So if I got a bunch of students and they're screwing up in class, anytime you make an error, you feel that jolt because your brain and your consciousness is saying, oh, there's something that could kill us in the future. We don't understand something about the world. You got to fix it now. Most kids will shut down after they make a mistake, not because they don't want to learn from it, but because they don't like the visceral sensation. They take it personally. It feels uncomfortable for them, and they go, nope, back to my old story.
This is a really fucking important point. How do you see people can overcome that? I mean, it takes a lot of emotional intelligence to be able to go, look, this, if you're going to do transformation of your life, it's a visceral, physical experience as well that your body is not always going to fucking like.
The two kind of methods I've found that have helped students get past hurdles are, one is you depersonalize it, which is doubly hard in your case when we're talking about personal development. To depersonalize that sensation is also to depersonalize the story from yourself. It's to recognize that, A, that sensation isn't me. It's not a reflection of my ability, skills. It's just the process of growth. And then for kids, that's pretty easy. But now to take an adult and say that process is also the process of changing your story. And don't take it personally. It's not your identity. Your story isn't your identity. You are actually more than it. In fact, your willingness to fight to maintain your identity is a sign that you are above that story. Right. If you're willing to fight for a story, you can't fight for a story if you live in that story. That shows that there's enough of you outside of the story recognizing that it exists, that you're willing to jump in and protect it like you would a child.
If you're in the story, you don't recognize it's a story. So as soon as you're fighting for it,
there's nothing to fight against.
There's a part of you that sits above that and recognizes that it's a story.
Uh-huh. Right.
So let's pretend your story is a baby.
Yeah.
Baby sitting there and a vulture is circling over. Baby doesn't protect itself. Why? Because baby is baby. Baby don't know what the hell is going on. Now you've got mother bird. Baby sitting there, vulture circling. Mother will fight to keep vulture away, to keep baby safe and intact. That's a demonstration that mother is separate from baby. Why? Because mother can step in when baby can't do something. If your identity were purely your story, there'd be nothing to defend. You're baby. You're as helpless. It's the world comes and goes as you see fit. Mm. Fact that you can, when somebody pushes back on a story and you can arc up to protect it, to say, no, I don't, I feel myself going into that editor mode. I don't like it. Let me go back to my old story. That's a sign that you've got a little mother bird in there, which means there's a part of you that must be separate from the story itself to sit above it and protect it.
Right.
That bit of you, that protector mother bird, that's more your identity than the story itself.
Right.
So if you can depersonalize and recognize when you're starting to fight back, that you fighting back is the thing that you want to click into to say, that's me. The story isn't cool. Let's change the story. It's the acknowledge that that's not going to change me, because who is that protector? That's the me that's going to stay steady throughout all of this process.
I think in the past we've had people that have had the assumption that in order to do any personal development work on themselves, like to the degree that we do it with the equilibration process, that you have to have something traumatic happen to you. But I think that in what you've just said there, you've demonstrated that that's actually not the case. That the case is that you just have to have an understanding that you have an identity that you're trying to protect. The identity that you're trying to protect is keeping you playing life at a particular level, and as a result of that, you don't know how to get out of your car and get and create a new one to take you to the next level. And I think that if the people who come through and actually do the work with us understand that they have an understanding of that concept. They don't know how to get into the new car and to create the new car, but they do know that it's possible, and they do know that they've got an identity that they're protecting and that they want to be more than that.
And that identity can come from everywhere. It doesn't have to come, you're absolutely right, from a trauma. People who make the shift from Democrat to Republican or from Green to Independent, that's the same process. Anytime you take something that you say is my identity, wherever that story came from, I grew up as a Republican because my parents were, and that was all I was ever fed. And then someday you get older, and through your reading, through your research, there's a moment where you stop and you go, wait a second, there's been enough change, there's been enough new ideas. I get it. I get the Republican argument, but now I also get the Democratic, and now I'm going to choose what I want to be. That process is exact. That's it. That's personal development. It's just, for whatever reason, people don't the political shift, and I'm just using politics because it's a simple, don't read anything into it.
Yeah.
But a political shift, most people don't, they don't personalize it. B, it's a real slow burn. It happens when it happens. But because of all those, people don't take it too seriously. It happens. Cool. Have a good one. Personal development says, you can do that whenever you want. There's no reason you need 20 years of experience to stop and ask the question that says, how do I reach that next level? How do I broaden my understanding of the world? And that's where I think you guys come in, is that it doesn't require trauma. It just requires any story that you want to change, that you're willing to take a look at and say, all right, what is it going to take to broaden my perspective out? Then you come in. That's personal development.
Can we delve in a little bit now? I mean, I've had people say to me, look, the brain is just a piece of matter, Mitch. You know, it's literally just a piece of matter that has some functions. But it seems now, I don't know whether you've read the book Stealing Fire, and if you haven't, I think you'd love it. But basically it's talking now about the processes of trying to hack consciousness, where, you know, Navy SEALs are doing what they can to hack consciousness, right through to Silicon Valley, where they're doing, you know, they're microdosing on certain hallucinogenics, trying to hack consciousness, and it's becoming a huge movement now, like a huge movement.
Yeah.
You have the owners of Google, you know, the way they found their CEO was they took him to a Burning Man festival and watched how he performed with over 7 days with other members of the team. And then took it back, and he took the company from $4 billion to I think $400 billion US dollars, like just huge. But it seems that there is a huge drive now to hacking consciousness, that it's gone beyond the brain. I mean, the brain with research. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not a neuroscientist. You're probably more down that end than I am. But obviously, but I think that it's moving away from the brain now. Like they're trying to understand. They were thinking that understanding the brain was going to help them understand consciousness, but it seems that it's the other way around. Would you agree?
Yeah, the old paradigm that the brain gives rise to consciousness, or that the brain is the seat of consciousness, is just so gone now.
Right.
So you've kind of got two theories where we stand now, and I'm a fan of the second more so than the first, and you'll see why in a second. Neither bother me. I just, where I stand at this moment. So the first one is that the brain is now viewed as a receiver, where before the brain was seen as very generative. As the action goes here, so you pop out, and that's your consciousness. The receiver model says, no, the brain is simply tapping into what's around you, like a kind of like a radio device. And how it's tuned will determine what your consciousness is. So when you do something like microdosing or something, you retune the antenna. It's like you move the antenna of your brain, and you can tap into more understanding consciousness out here.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't bother me in the least. But I still feel that as being, believe it or not, too brain-centric. So far as I'm concerned, that still relies on the brain as being some sort of mechanism whereby your consciousness requires this.
Right.
Where I come from,
this meaning the brain, nobody can see you, Jared.
Sorry.
You were pointing to your head, brain.
Pointing to my noggin.
He was pointing to his penis right there.
This controls me. Now that's very true. Now, so that's one aspect, and I'm totally fine with that. The other one is the emergent aspect. We've talked about this several times in the past, and it just, the more I play with it, the deeper I get with it, the more I'm like, this is it. So emergence says, when you combine things together, their interaction leads to properties that are not existent in the individual pieces and totally unpredictable by the pieces. Those properties sit above the pieces. They live at the interaction point, and they sit above and can feed back into the pieces. So simple example.
So you're talking epigenetics. You're talking outward influence. Yep. Okay.
Boom. And so we'll call it epiphenomenon. Okay. I call it emergent properties, but we'll call it epiphenomenon. Best way to explore it. So you imagine you've got a yellow circle and a red circle. Mm-hmm. Now, if you had perfect knowledge of yellow, you knew everything there was to know about yellow. Imagine that yellow circle is your entire universe and you've got it on lockdown. With perfect knowledge of yellow, do you know that a thing called orange exists in the world?
Well, the answer is yes and no.
Oh, imagine your entire universe was nothing but yellow. Yeah.
Well, no,
so
you wouldn't know that orange existed in the world.
So we could say that with perfect knowledge of yellow, you don't know orange exists because orange isn't in yellow. It's right. Not a property of yellow.
Right.
Move to red world. Your entire universe is red. You know everything about red. Perfect knowledge of red world. Do you know orange exists?
No.
Because it ain't in red. Orange isn't a property of red. What do I got to do? So we've agreed orange isn't in yellow. It's not in red. Perfect knowledge of each doesn't tell you anything about it.
Yeah.
What do I got to do to get orange?
Combine them.
I bring them together. Orange emerges at the interaction between yellow and red. Pull the two apart and you don't get 50% orange in one, 50% orange in the other. It's gone. There is literally nothing left to talk about.
Yeah.
Bring them together and out it emerges again. So orange can only meaningfully be discussed at the level of interaction between yellow and red when it appears, when it becomes real, when it manifests as the property. What science has perennially done is reductionism. It says, let's go backwards. Orange is made of yellow and red, ergo I just explained orange. Emergence says, no, you didn't explain it. By pulling the two apart, you literally destroyed it. There's nothing – you didn't explain it. You explained it away. You pretended it didn't exist. Mm. So why does this matter for consciousness? So let's build up biology. Biology starts with cells. Put a bunch of cells together, you get tissues. Put a bunch of tissues together, you get organs. Put a bunch of organs together, you build systems. Put a bunch of systems together, you build a person. What – at each of these levels, things emerge that don't exist. If you can assume our building block is a cell, each time we add more cells and move up those levels to tissue, to organ, to us, new things emerge that when we move backwards disappear because they're not in the cell themselves. Uh-huh. So once you get to the level of consciousness of us, of saying you as a human being are very different than this. You are not your brain. You are. What I mean is you are an emergent property of all of this. You come out of the interaction between all the cells, structures, and organs in your body. When they all interact, just like orange, you pop out of that. Mm. You're not in any of it. You are of all of it.
Right.
You're not in your brain any more than you're in your kneecap, any more than you're in your elbow. You're of all of these pieces. You're of all of the interaction. You emerge from their interaction, but you ain't in there. Mm-hmm. And you are uniquely different. Because of that, you are uniquely different from them. Now, the thing that makes the you, the conscious you, so when I say, Mitch, you drive this machine, it doesn't drive you, I'm not talking to a part of your brain. I'm not talking to a little nugget. I'm not talking to a receiver. I'm talking about the you that is qualitatively different than all of this, that emerges when all of these pieces come together.
Combined.
Right.
Boom. Now, the thing that separates you, Mitch, from the color orange is when orange emerges from yellow and red, it doesn't feed back. It doesn't really do much of anything. You still have orange, yellow, you still have red, and now you have orange. Cool. In biology, when we emerge, biology has what are called feedback loops. So once you emerge from all of this, believe it or not, now you can feed back and change all of this.
Mm, right.
And that if that sentence alone should stop 90% of the world in their tracks. When the weight of that sentence comes out.
So just say it again.
You are different than your body. You are not in your body. You are of your body. You are an emergent property. You exist completely different than your biology. because you emerge through the interaction of all of your biology.
Got it, yep.
Ergo, the Mitch that I talk to is not the biology Mitch. It's the Mitch that emerges from you.
Right.
Unlike Orange, the emergent you, Mitch, can feed back on and change your biology.
Right.
So you pop out of the interaction between your brain, your heart, your stomach, your legs, your hands. You pop out of that interaction.
Yeah.
And once you emerge, even though you're not in any of this, somehow the you above it all can feed back on and change how the brain functions, change how the stomach functions, change how the heart functions.
Yeah.
You popped out of all this, and now you can go back and change all of it.
Right.
And that's not even a controversial statement. That's just a maxim in biology.
Right.
But when you really stop and think about it, the weight of that is fucking phenomenal.
Huge.
It is ridiculous. You wouldn't exist without your biology. But because you popped out of your biology, you can somehow change it all. Take it even simple. So let's a simpler example. Let's just take a car. So imagine you have a car engine. You love cars, right, Mitch?
Love them.
Love them. So you got a car engine, right?
Yeah.
Does that car engine have any speed whatsoever?
No.
It's got moving parts, but there's no speed in it. What do I got to do to get speed?
I got to give it acceleration and fuel and gas.
I need an engine and gas and wheels and an axle.
And an axle, yeah.
So would you say speed is in the wheels?
No.
Is it in the axle?
No.
Is it in the gas?
No.
So it's not in any of the parts. It emerges only when all those parts interact. It sits above the parts.
Right.
So it's not in the parts, it's of the parts. Put them all together, now I get speed.
Yeah.
Interestingly, now you drive your car at 500 miles an hour down a bumpy road for 10 miles.
Yeah.
That speed is going to feed back on and start to change the parts. All of a sudden, the tires get flat, the axle gets chipped, everything kind of gets started broken down. So you get this feedback loop where speed comes out of the interaction and feeds back on and changes the parts that made it.
Right.
In that example, the feedback is highly mechanical. It's not actually doing anything.
Yeah.
But in our biological example, when you emerge from your body, just by pure thought, you can feed back on. You don't have to run down a dusty track. Through your thinking, through taking ownership of the you can feed back on and change how all of this biology functions.
That's fucking insane.
It's some of the heaviest shit in the world.
That's insane. So
going back to – so this is your second – so what was the original question though?
We were talking about hacking consciousness.
So
when we talk about all these people who want to hack consciousness, we come at it from two angles. Is a lot of them are coming at it from the receiver angle.
Yeah.
If I can change chemicals in my brain, I can change the receiver.
Yep. Right.
What I'm saying is, what if they're coming at it from the emergent side? So check this out. If you emerge from your body, you know your cells exist, yeah?
Yeah.
Do your cells know that you exist?
Probably not. I don't know. It's very unlikely.
By and large, we'd typically say no.
No.
My heart doesn't know I exist, but I know my heart exists.
Yeah.
So emergent properties in biology have knowledge of everything beneath it and can influence it, but the things beneath don't really know what's going on above. So, okay, you have a body. You, Mitch, emerge from your body.
Yeah.
Now, emergence can't stop with us. If emergence is an actual thing, it doesn't end when you pop out of your body. Once you put a bunch of individuals together, something has to emerge above that.
Mm.
And once you get a bunch of groups of people together, something has to emerge above that. And just like your cell doesn't know you exist, when you get a bunch of human beings together and something emerges above that, we got no clue it exists, but I promise you it knows we exist. And we don't know what the hell it is, but I assure you it can feed back on and influence us just like we can.
Very good.
So now take it back to consciousness hacking and the microdosing and the ayahuasca and people trying to get in. The argument – so you've got one argument which says these pills and stuff shift your brain, shift your frequencies. You tap into a new consciousness. Cool. Emergence says, what if by taking these drugs, taking these pills, going into these trances, what you're really doing is momentarily putting your head into the emergent property that's above us and getting a glimpse from that level back down on you.
Like yeah. the heart so, cell knowing that what the, yeah.
Right.
Bingo. Imagine your heart momentarily recognizes, oh shit,
Cooney,
Jared is a thing. I'm a part of him. And in that moment, my heart gets pure knowledge of me. And it's like, oh, I get it. I get how all the systems work. I get out. Ah. And what does the heart do? In that moment, it's pure calmness because it gets it all. But of course, it can't hold that consciousness. So the heart goes right back to just being a heart. It had a moment of what we'll call transcendence.
Right.
I wonder if that's not what these consciousness hackers are doing by putting in unique chemicals and stuff into their body or trances. They're pushing themselves into a realm where they can tap into the consciousness or the emergent property that sits above us.
Yeah.
Get the bird's eye view of themselves. And in that moment, you don't feel elation. You don't feel great. You just get it. Everything.
Yeah.
You get that perfect knowledge of, I see how all the pieces, I know who I am. I know how these, none of this matters. That's important. None of this shit matters. But you can't hold that forever. So what do? Shoom, you zip back down to just our level. And you're back to normal. But now you've come with this knowledge, this understanding that you've grasped from up here.
Yeah.
So the transistor model suggests that there's all this information floating around. We just got to grab it. The emergent model says, yep, that information isn't willy-nilly. It's coherent in a emergent thing above us. There's a something just like you're out of your body. There's something above us. And by hacking your consciousness, you're able to tap into that knowledge pool. Cool. Understand it for a split second and then come back down. Wow. Which is the big joke. If you ask people who have tapped their consciousness, who have gone through some of these sessions, almost to a person, none of them come back exhilarated, like, oh, let's change the world. They come back calm as a motherfucker.
Yep.
Highly, highly focused as though they get it.
Yeah.
That's the knowledge. That's the tapping into the world above us.
Yeah. And that's what they're doing. They're talking about, you know, they're talking about flow states. They're talking about stir, which is selflessness, timelessness, effortlessness, and richness, where they're tapping into stir and into these flow states, what they're feeling is that in these flow states, they're able to access greater insights and greater sense of knowledge and wisdom and understanding. It's fascinating to read and learn about, you know, because it seems that, you know, they're doing what the mystics were. Mysticism is becoming the new pursuit. It's really incredible.
If you go the transistor model, then by and large, you need to change your chemicals, which is why drugs would really work.
Yeah.
But if you go the emergent model, then that's when drugs could push you there, but you don't need drugs now.
How do you do it? I've equilibrated things, I've tapped into these insights of perfection and understanding, and now, you know, push pull goes away, and I'm in this state of flow and love and just and understanding, and it's almost like a giggle, like life becomes a giggle, you know, everything becomes so insignificant, you know, like we're just dust, and in that we're nothing and we're everything, you know, and that's why I just love it so much, you know.
If you're not using drugs, do you like how else do you do? Is that what you're saying, Mitch?
So that's why I got something like equilibration has got to be one of the ways to tap into it.
Yeah.
If you go through that process, if drugs were required, then that should do nothing. Mm. You should go through the process and come out exactly the same. If people who meditate and say they get it, they reach that state through meditation. The old Sufi dancers, the whirling dervishes, who used to just, you don't need an external chemical. It's somehow a state that we can achieve through the tools that we have at our disposal here.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying chemicals are bad, man. Go have your ayahuasca sure that's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
But the emergent says, well, no, clearly you don't need all of that stuff. So I'm really interested in what is the mechanism by which you just automatically tap into it. Mm. And I think that's what a lot of us have been searching for. And I think that's equilibration is one of those methods whereby people have found, look, this is so long as I walk that path, it kicks me right up in here.
Mm. Yep.
Solid. Which is freaking awesome.
Jared, we are getting the roll on, so we are going to have to kind of end it there. It's always, I'm looking at the time going, I could actually spend another, 2 hours talking and diving deep into this with you. Yeah.
So well, we got to do next time you guys are out in Melbourne, we're getting wine and let's just get
we'll get a big pot of ayahuasca, mate, and we'll just head out into the jungle
and just see what the hell happens.
See what happens.
We'll just, mate, we'll puke
and you can tell us about what's going on at the brain at the same time. Okay. I remember watching one of the Conor McGregor fights and Jared's texting me at the same time as the McGregor fights.
This is bottom up, top
down. Okay, no, he's in bottom up at the moment. No, he's in top down now. Now he's in bottom up.
Now he's just playing. He's on autopilot.
Now he's on autopilot. His brain is doing that.
Insane to watch, wasn't it? It was like, wow, you know.
It was the one where he wasn't
Mayweather.
That was funny. And his journey since then has just been so much fun to watch, from his ups to his downs, and just watching him here.
Yeah,
the dude is just a star to watch. He knows brilliant. What he's doing.
Did you see Tony Robbins was in the ring on the last fight?
No.
Yes, Tony Robbins is the big mammoth of a dude standing behind him when he in that last fight, Cowboy Cerrone. He was
in his corner.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a tag team match. So if he's getting knocked out, Robbins just comes in, hits people, just clears out the ring. He's good to go.
Jared, this has been awesome. Yeah. We really appreciate your time. It's been great. I know that our listeners are going to love this.
Yeah, and we might split this in two even.
Well, who knows? Maybe. We'll see what the guys say. But I know you've got so much more to say. I know we've had deep discussions about kids and parenting and teenagers and stuff. So
can I just say to get this chap's book?
And especially if you're interested in how people learn and how people, how we take in information. Your book is amazing for that. So it's Stop Talking, Start Influencing. And I, like I said, I only found out about the TED Talk today, so I'm going to go listen to that, and I'm sure that's amazing too.
Were you on camera for this TED Talk?
Yeah, TEDx. It was TEDx. So cool. TEDx. It was one of the TEDx, but it was run by a group of high schoolers.
Right.
So the whole thing was produced, developed by teenage kids. It was one of the coolest. I was so lucky to be a part of that. All I wanted to do, I wanted my talk to just be, turn the cameras on the people who put this together. These kids are, look at the work they're doing.
Wow. Yeah.
Teenagers going to school, acing tests, still have time to put this on because they care that much about their community that they want to get ideas at.
Wow.
Yeah. I was so lucky to be a part of that. I loved it.
Beautiful.
Okay, brother.
All right, Jared,
sending
thank you
love
so
and hugs.
Much. We love
Dude,
you.
Dude, thank you guys.
Take care, my man.
If you found this information inspiring, make sure you subscribe and tune in to the next Dorothy and the Dealer podcast.